The state of Florida says it won't give President Trump's Commission on Voter Fraud all the information it's asking for. Still, charges are flying this morning. The state is being too compliant with that federal request for voters' personal information. Good Tuesday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, never miss a show. Download the WJCT app, listen to us there anytime, or on iTunes, or stream us live right now on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Just ahead, why Florida groups are mobilizing in opposition to President Trump's voter fraud panel, as it's called. Get on the line now. What do you think? 549-2937. Then later, Movable Feast hears from Joe Finnegan of the St. Francis Inn in Casa de Suenas in St. Augustine. Plus, celebrating the life and legacy of Henry David Thoreau. That's on our book club today. All of that ahead. But first this hour, controversy over Florida's decision to hand over some voter information to President Trump's new Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. Florida Secretary of State Ken Detzner says he's only going to hand over some of the information to this commission, what's already publicly available. Detzner says he will not give out driver's license or social security numbers to the commission among any of us Florida voters. The commission is looking into whether or not, as President Trump contends, there was voter fraud in the most recent presidential election, and asking states to hand over voter registration information going back as far as 2006. This commission is also called the Voter Fraud Panel, and they want names, dates of birth, voting histories, party registrations, the last four digits of voters' social security numbers, and other pieces of information. 44 states have refused to hand over all or part of this data. And lawsuits are already being filed over the request, citing the commission's intrusion into voter expectation of privacy. What does all this mean for Florida? Well, Pamela Goodman is president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, and she's on the line now with her thoughts. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you this morning.
And here's our question to callers. What's your reaction to the President's Commission on Voter Integrity and requests for voters' personal information? And what do you think about Florida complying with at least part of this request? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. Or weigh in on our Facebook page, where we are streaming this live right now. Pamela Goodman, the Florida League of Women Voters is protesting the decision by Secretary of State Ken Detzner to hand over some voter information to the Presidential Commission. What's your reaction to the statement from our Secretary of State saying he will not hand over driver's license numbers or Social Security numbers, Florida voter data that this presidential commission wants? What's your organization's reaction?
Well, Melissa, first of all, I do want to clarify. We sent a very pointed letter to the secretary, and we are not we did not oppose him handing over the information that is publicly accessible. You know, our secretary was caught in a legal conundrum. The data that he has agreed to release is accessible in public records. So there's really nothing legally that could stop him in the state of Florida or stop anyone from gaining access to that limited amount of information. Secretary Detzner actually did exactly what we asked him to do, to only make accessible the information that was already publicly accessible. So we, in his decision, which was made a day after he received our letter, we were not completely disappointed with that. The bigger picture in all of this is what is happening at the federal level. And this commission has been called many things, as you just pointed out, voter fraud and so-called election integrity. But this commission at the federal level is truly laying the groundwork for potential voter suppression by removing eligible voters, including Black, Hispanic, elderly, and student voters from the rolls. This is part of a very wide effort to suppress the vote, keep certain politicians in power, and truly undermine our elections by spreading falsehoods about our election system. It is constantly said about voter fraud in this country for years, and there has not been one court case where it has been proven. Secretary Kobach specifically also, I have to point out, has a long record personally of discriminatory and really regressive actions on voting rights. He has a history of attempts to suppress voting that has led to thousands of voters being removed from the rolls. He's been brought to court, and he's lost several times for suppressing the constitutional rights of citizens to vote in his own home state of Kansas. And most recently, he was fined by a federal magistrate judge for patently misleading representations to the court. So it seems obvious that the commission members' views on elections are well known. The members have already been discredited as very political ideologues with very dangerous agendas. We do not believe that this federal commission is interested in facts, but rather false accusations. And we believe that this commission intends to use its findings and the information that it was searching for to legitimize policies that are well known to really prevent eligible voters from having a voice in our elections. It is a dangerous, dangerous commission, and that is where our concern lies, is with this commission at the federal level.
Wow, aggressive pushback from the League of Women Voters of Florida. We'll go to your calls in a moment, 549-2937. Now, Pamela Goodman, let me ask you as well. On Monday, we learned that the commission has put a freeze on its effort to collect sensitive voter data from states, particularly in the face of growing legal challenges. The ACLU, as might be expected, has filed a lawsuit over this. There have been other lawsuits filed. The commission's designated officer, his name's Andrew Cossack, has asked state elections officers to hold off on submitting any data due to the complaint that's been filed by ACLU alleging violations of federal law requiring transparent government. So given that, and given that most U.S. states have rejected full compliance with this, how do you see this playing out over time? Are we going to eventually see more data handed over or not? Hard to see how the courts will rule, but from where you sit as head of Florida's League of Women Voters, how can we game this out? Where is this going?
Well, I think obviously it's going to the courts, and it's going to be at the federal level. We were very pleased with the filing of the ACLU's court case yesterday at the federal level. Both our national organization and all of the state leagues across the country supported that strongly. So I don't think that anyone will be handing over or making this information accessible anytime soon. But you know, to get back to Florida, the public accessible information that once again, you know, anyone can access. Look, the political parties use that information to help get out the vote. During election times, many organizations that work on voter outreach use that information in a very good way to remind voters about the election, to help them update their voter registration. So that information, I want to make clear, is not used for negative purposes in the state of Florida currently. It is used for really positive voter outreach and helping to make elections more accessible and helping to alert voters of information that they need. But once again, certainly the issue on this is at the federal level, the concern about this commission and specifically the request for the information that is not publicly accessible. So that is past voter history, the social security numbers, you know, dangerous violations of privacy. And once again, pleased that the ACLU has filed this case, and we also have serious questions about the legality of releasing, you know, any of that very, very personal information.
The Times Union editorial board printed an op-ed today. The normally conservative-leaning op-ed page of the TU opined against this whole matter, writing, "Does the provision of this information violate the expectation of a voter's privacy? We think it does," opines the TU. Will it come down then to this privacy argument? Because we've seen bipartisan pushback from both blue and red states saying that that this violates voters' expectation of privacy. Is that the privacy argument seems to cut across all political lines?
It does. And once again, it is what elements of that information are held under the Privacy Act. And certainly the information that Florida said that they would not release, the Social Security information, as I said, the voter history information. They even wanted the history if you were enlisted in any of the armed forces. Clearly, once again, I want to go back to my original points. Clearly, one must question, what are they doing with this information? They never said. They call themselves the Election Integrity Commission. But in our history, this kind of information has been used for only one purpose, and that is not to help make voting accessible to individuals. It is to suppress voting to certain individuals. It is to purge voting rolls of certain individuals. That happens. That is a fact. It has happened in many, many, many states in our country. So that is the League of Women Voters' main concern. And as I said, Mr. Kobach's history certainly does not show himself as someone who is supportive of voter rights and voter
accessibility. And that's the Kansas Secretary of State, just so people understand. You're referring to the Kansas Secretary of State, Kris Kobach, who's leading this Presidential Commission on Voter Integrity. Let me ask you to push back against all of these claims. What would you say to those listening who like this effort by the president? They are concerned about people casting ballots illegally. And since a lot of this information is already publicly available, why not just hand it over?
Well, once again, our Secretary of State, Dentzer, really didn't have a choice because it is publicly accessible. We believe before it is handed over that, again, what is going to be done with it, how this commission is going to use this information in a positive way is the legality and the real issue that we need to be concerned about. What is troubling is that in the state of Florida, it's troubling, I guess, and it's also good. There actually have been citizens who, now that this issue has been raised, have been concerned about being registered to vote and have considered, not registering or asking to be removed from the rolls. I can only reiterate to your listeners and to everyone who is a citizen and of voting age, voting is the one thing that brings us together as Americans. It's the one time when we are all truly equal. And voting is everyone's opportunity to support your community and have a say in America's future. Every vote truly counts, and our vote makes a difference at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level. And so for this act at the federal level, which once again, we are fighting, and the courts will be fighting, I can only encourage people to not go the other way and not exercise the right that is so precious to us as citizens in the state and in this country. And I encourage all eligible voters to continue to register, update their registrations, and most importantly, participate in our elections. Because if you don't, this federal act will accomplish exactly what it is trying to do, suppress the voice and vote of every American in this country.
And it's 549-2937. Give us a call as we speak with Pamela Goodman, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida, about President Trump's voter fraud panel. It's also called the Presidential Commission on Election Integrity. What do you think about Florida's decision to hand over some voter data to this commission? It's 549-2937. And you mentioned the importance of people registering to vote. What would you say to those, particularly we had a report here on our air just the other day in Volusia County of people going to that county's supervisor of elections and saying, remove my name from the rolls. I don't want my personal information shared.
Right. And as I said, if citizens react in that way, this commission will accomplish exactly what it is trying to do, and that is to suppress, you know, our voice and our vote. So I strongly encourage people not to do that. This is in the courts. Great organizations like the League and ACLU and many, many, many others are working round the clock 24/7 every day of the year to make sure that voters have accessibility to the polls, that their rights are protected. And certainly when an issue like this has arisen, which is a first-time issue, so, you know, we're learning as we go, but with an unbelievable legal counsel that is being done pro bono around this country on this issue right now, the Brennan Center out of NYU, Myrna Perez, who has been great counsel to many states in the country on this issue, is working on the legal aspects of this as diligently as possible and will be in the courts fighting this and ensuring that voters' rights are protected.
Okay, let's go to your calls. It's your chance to weigh in on this as we speak with Pamela Goodman, president of the Nonpartisan League of Women Voters of Florida, 549-2937. Jose is on the south side. Hi, Jose. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. I'm 100% for that investigation. If you ain't got nothing to hide, what's the problem? Plus, Donald Trump claimed that there was a lot of fraud and there were millions. I think that's a win-win for the other political party to expose Trump. He's telling the truth or not. What is there to hide? I'm sorry, but to me, that smells. If you really want to know and show the truth that there was no fraud, why you guys oppose me? Because you said that it's public records. And the other thing that you mentioned, that voting oppression or whatever it is, I'm sorry, I don't believe that for a single minute. You go to any country in the world, you have to present a valid ID. And to me, that's not a suppression or whatever name you want to call it. To me, there's something fishy there, and you guys don't want the truth to come out. What's so harmful to expose if Trump is telling the truth or not? It's a win-win for the Democrats. Why are they opposing it? That's my point.
Okay, thanks, Jose. Pamela.
Well, yeah, Jose, thank you. And you're mentioning the Democrats as a particular the party that is fighting this. I really do have to point out, number one, the League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan organization, has been since 1920, close to 100 years. We do not support any political candidates or political parties. And as Melissa pointed out at the beginning of the broadcast, Secretary of State in both blue and red states have not agreed to submit this information. So I clearly want to ensure that this is not one party that is fighting this. This is nonpartisan or a bipartisan effort. You are absolutely 100% right in the information that is public records. We agree with you. Can be released and should be released. But once again, the question is, In your summation, you're saying, of course, we want everything to be transparent. And what is someone trying to hide? We would question, what is this commission's true motivation? What are they trying to hide? What are they going to do with this information? And if they say they are going to prove that there is voter fraud, that urban myth has been around for years in many states throughout this country. No legal case has ever proven that that is a fact. So there is no reason to believe that this commission, by gaining additional voter data that really is protected under privacy acts, particularly in Florida, I can only speak about our own state, but Social Security numbers, driver's license numbers, your Armed Forces service, is protected by the Privacy Act. And how would that information, what are they going to do with it? Who are they going to release it to? How is it even going to be transmitted to them to ensure that it's not hacked by other organizations, by other people, by other countries, which, of course, has been an issue? So those are all of our concerns. It's more questions than answers, and that's why we believe it has to be in the courts at this point in time.
To be clear, state officials from both parties, election experts across the political spectrum, have widely agreed that voter fraud in this country is rare. That said, Pamela Goodman, when you listen to Jose, he clearly believes the president's claim that millions of people in this country voted illegally. There is absolutely no evidence to support that, however.
There is not. Anyone can make that statement. And once again, you know, let's verify statements and look for the proof that that exists. And it has not. I would put forth that if there is any organization that would be certainly and has been looking for voter fraud or voter suppression, it is the League of Women Voters in every state in this country, and other organizations such as the ACLU protecting civil liberties. And it just has not been proven for years. This is not a new claim. This is a claim that has been going on for years.
All right, let's go to, hang on 1 second. Let me just get a few calls on the air. Let's go to Tom in downtown Jacksonville. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to let people know that removing yourself from the voter rolls now isn't going to remove the historical data they're looking for. Thank you.
Thanks, Tom. Pat on Amelia Island. Go ahead, Pat.
Hi. Good day. My call is in relation to her question that, or her response that there has never been a voter fraud. I was notified by a voter registration that after I turned in the information, that both of my grandparents' Social Security cards, well, not their Social Security cards, their Social Security numbers, were stolen when their death certificates were stolen from my home. And my question is two parts. I am just one person in this little tiny pool in this world that it happened to both of my grandparents. Who's to say that this does not happen to all of our soldiers that have been killed in the world wars? And what is happening to their Social Security numbers? So giving our last four of a Social Security number is not going to harm us in any way. Okay. It may help us with voter fraud.
Thanks, Pat. Okay, what about that? Pamela.
Well, interesting point. But I think the one thing that we have to keep in mind is that voter registration is very separate from actual voting. So there's a lot of claims of people registering in two states, and you know, Mickey Mouse registering and dead people registering to vote. We have to remember, when you go to vote, you show a voter identification card, you sign your signature, whether it's an absentee ballot or when you go to vote, your signature has to match that signature that's on file when you registered to vote. So there's a lot of double checks and balances in our voting system that certainly people can fill out a voter registration form and you know, use information on that, even though when they sign it, it's a felony if it's misrepresented. But there's a double check before that person actually votes that person who registered is actually that person. So I think everyone needs to clearly understand the difference between voter registration and actual voting, and the checks and balances that we have in place to ensure that that process is safe.
Thanks so much for being with us and sharing your thoughts.
Sure, anytime.
All right, Pamela Goodman, president of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Much more still ahead later. It's our book club today as leader Stacy Goldring celebrates the life and legacy of Henry David Thoreau, born 200 years ago this week. But up next, Movable Feast peeks inside two historic inns in St. Augustine. Back in a moment.
Next time on 1A, Taking on the Trolls, we'll look at the very latest evidence on the growing problem of online harassment. Millions suffer daily, but the balance between free speech and personal protection is tricky. Who makes the rules? And what is the best way to slay a troll? Next time on 1A, weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Who is your American Graduate Champion? WJCT is looking to recognize and honor a wide range of community leaders and everyday heroes who regularly dedicate their time, talent, and resources to prepare students for success and graduation. American Graduate Champions are role models in their communities whose stories have the potential to inspire others to take action. The nomination deadline is July 17th. Click the button on WJCT.org to nominate your American Graduate Champion today.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Well, the nation's oldest city is known for its charming bed and breakfast inns. One family owns two of the most popular B&Bs in St. Augustine. In today's Movable Feast, our look at dining and culinary and entertainment trends around the area, Lee Cord of the Women's Food Alliance talks with Joe Finnegan, owner of the 1791 St. Francis Inn and the Casa de Suenas.
Have a banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. Give it to gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house. Try a tomato plate too.
I would love to share the story about how and your wife Margaret got interested in the bed and breakfast industry and how you ended up in St. Augustine.
I'm not sure your program is long enough for me to respond to that question, but thank you for asking and I'll give it a shot. And thank you for inviting me to be here this morning. My wife and I came to St. Augustine separately and both ended up working at the School for the Deaf and Blind. And got married and left St. Augustine to further our career in that same venture. But like so many people, when we left St. Augustine, we knew this was home and that we would return someday. And so after working in Pennsylvania and South Carolina, we had the opportunity to return to St. Augustine and acquire the St. Francis Inn, and that was 32 years ago. And so we have been the owners, operators of St. Francis Inn, and it was partly the inn, but also partly the lure of St. Augustine that brought us back to Northeast Florida. And then over the years, we acquired Casa de Solana.
Oh, I remember that, yes.
Operated that property for 7 years and sold that. And then 2 years ago, we acquired the Casa de Sueños.
You know, not many people in the bed and breakfast industry have such longevity of time of ownership. 32 years is a long time in the bed and breakfast industry or any aspect of the hospitality industry. What is it about the St. Francis Inn that has kept you connected and as passionate now as ever?
There are many reasons for that. A couple of the reasons, however, would be that we both had outside interests. We both had outside employment. So the inn was not our only or even our primary source of income. My wife, even today, is still a full-time professor at Flagler College and has been for the duration of the time that we've, most of the time that we've owned the inn. So we've not been day in and day out tied to the inn. We've had other interests and other resources.
But there are very few days that I go to the St. Francis Inn that I don't see you there with your staff. Everybody's so personally connected and passionate about guest service and making your guests happy. And you're very accessible to your guests.
Well, that's the second reason why I think we were able to continue as we have, and that is the having great staff, having a good number of staff, and having great staff. We believe in staff development, staff training, and so we do a lot of that with the staff. And we offer fair compensation with benefits to help attract and keep staff, but key staff, good staff is really the, I think, the reason we've been able to maintain our involvement for so long.
Yes, and that's the heartbeat of any hospitality organization, whether it's a restaurant, a hotel, bed and breakfast, where there are guests who are searching for personal, just personal joy and satisfaction through their travels.
Our guests come to the inns, and this is true, I think, for people who go to bed and breakfast in general, and St. Augustine's got some great bed and breakfast.
At least 30 that I know
of. Yeah, really, really good. People, the bed and breakfast is an experience. It's not just a bed or a breakfast, for that matter. It's the experience, and the experience is created by the people who work there. The owners set the tone and the philosophy, and the staff carry that out day in and day out with all the guests. And so that's what guests are looking for at a bed and breakfast. This is an experience. Mm-hmm. And if you stay in a historic property downtown, that just expands and enhances the experience of visiting historic St. Augustine.
The magic of the city, of course, is something that many of us know about. The magic of the inn happens when, even before you check in, you have an expectation of something. And when you talk about the breakfast side, definitely the St. Francis Inn comes to mind, because your inn is not just a bed and breakfast. It's a little boutique hotel. I know that you have multiple accommodations that are part of the St. Francis Inn experience. Share that with our listeners.
In addition to the 17 guest rooms that we have downtown that are right there where the St. Francis Inn is located, we also have 6 beach properties. One over at Comanche Harbor, and 5 out on St. Augustine Beach. And our guests are able to stay there and still come into the inn for breakfast and the evening social, and all the other amenities are offered that are offered in guests, but they're sleeping arrangement where they're staying is 6 miles away at St. Augustine
Beach.
And
that is so rare, to be able to have a beach experience, especially for the family or the multi-generational getaway, to have a larger home and to actually access the historic inn downtown and have parking.
And the flip side of that is that, yes, the parking that the beach guests get when they come to St. Augustine, because they can park in
and
the inn's
versa.
Lot. But the flip side of that is the inn guests from both inns have the opportunity for a beach experience. We provide on B Street, St. Augustine Beach, we provide parking, a private restroom with a full hot shower, beach towels, beach chairs, or cold water for the inn guests. So if they want to spend a couple of hours at the beach or a whole day at the beach, they can go out to our property out there, park out there, don't have to drive on the beach or pay for the beach pass, and then enjoy their experience at the beach, clean up, go to dinner out at the beach, come back into town, whatever. So it's the beach people who stay out there get the inn amenities. The inn guests who stay in town get the beach amenities. The social activity between and among the guests at both of our inns really centers around the food and beverage aspect of our hospitality. And we have three major events a day of food and beverage. One, of course, is breakfast. The second one is what we call our evening social hour, which is 5 to 6 each day. And then we do a homemade complimentary dessert in the evening from 8 to 9.
Now, to me, that's the happy hour. Late night, coming back after a day in St. Augustine, relaxing and having a glass of wine or a specialty coffee and one of your cook's amazing desserts.
Yeah, the desserts are popular.
We could probably talk for days about the bed and breakfast phenomenon, your bed and breakfasts in St. Augustine. I hope you'll join me again and we can talk about the Casa de Sueños and maybe sprinkle a little ghost story in there somewhere the next time you join me.
I'd be happy to come back.
So thank you, and I look forward to seeing you in the courtyard with a glass of wine at the St. Francis Inn.
Thank you.
Thanks,
anytime,
Joe.
Any day.
Everybody eats when they come to my house.
And we'll be right back.
On the next Fresh Air, why was only one corporate executive convicted after the financial meltdown of 2008? We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning ProPublica reporter Jesse Eisinger. His new book is about why the Justice Department fails to prosecute executives. And we'll talk about the Trump administration's business policies and how they contradict his populist rhetoric. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Want to learn more about stress management? Join WJCT and Baptist Health for Girls Day Out Saturday, August 26th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Spend the day with experts that will engage you to be a better you. Enjoy breakfast, lunch, session, gift bag, and so much more. Tickets are just $40. Log on to wjct.org/girlsdayout and get your tickets today.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part two.
Oliver Jones is the most famous living jazz musician you've probably never heard of. This week on Jazz Night in America, we'll introduce you to the 81-year-old Canadian pianist and protege of Oscar Peters. He celebrated his retirement this year with a special performance at the Montreal Jazz Festival, and we were there to bid him farewell. Check it out this week on Jazz Night in America. I'm Christian McBride.
Saturdays at 8 p.m. and Thursdays at 11 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour. This week marks the bicentennial birthday of Thoreau. Henry David Thoreau was an American essayist, poet, philosopher, abolitionist, and historian, among other things that he did. He was also a leading transcendentalist. But Thoreau is best known today for his classic Walden, a reflection on simple living in natural surroundings, and also his essay Civil Disobedience. It was an argument for disobedience to an unjust state. The life, works, and legacy of Henry David Thoreau being celebrated this month by book lovers around the world. So naturally, we're going to have a little birthday celebration today on our book club. Our book club leader, Stacey Goldring, is here now with her thorough thoughts. Good morning.
Oh, I love that. My thorough thoughts.
That's right.
Wonderful. That was a beautiful introduction. Very transcendental.
Thank you.
It was very self-reliant. I can tell that you wrote it yourself.
I did.
You had no masters telling you what to do.
Nope.
And that's kind of true.
Kevin Murchard's looking over my shoulder, but he doesn't tell me what to do.
Oh,
and that's good.
And
I don't tell him
what
to do.
He nurtures. He nurtures.
Yes, I don't tell him what to do either.
Well, let me tell you a little bit about Thoreau. I was going to talk about another book today, A Gentleman in Moscow, which is a very hot summer read right now. But I'm putting a pin in that, as they say.
Okay.
And we're going to talk about Thoreau because today is his 200th birthday.
Very cool.
So up in
1817.
I mean, that's a long time ago. And he is a very interesting man. And I thought, you know what? A lot of people have heard about Walden or have seen it or have traveled up there, but I wanted to kind of tell you a little bit about him so we can understand when we talk about Thoreau what we're really talking about. So here's a guy who lived in Concord his whole life.
Concord.
Massachusetts.
Massachusetts.
And he's kind of like a millennial because when he graduated from Harvard, it was tough times, very difficult to find a job. And basically, if you went to Harvard, you could do like four things. You could go into the ministry, law, government, teaching, blah, blah. So he tried teaching. That did not work. So he went to work with his dad in a pencil factory. His parents owned a pencil, or I should say his dad, because women could not own. His dad owned a pencil factory known as one of the best factory pencil makers in America at the time. And so he was making pencils with his dad, and then he decided to start a school with his brother. So he wanted to branch out on his own. And you know, there's that saying, it's all who you know. It helps if your next door neighbor happens to be the famous American transcendental philosopher, Emerson.
Ralph Waldo Emerson
was his next door neighbor, and he, our Thoreau, became a protege, a mentor, and actually a handyman. You know, it's always good to have someone who can fix the pipes.
While pondering transcendental things.
You know. So he actually ends up moving into the Emerson home, and where he learns from Emerson and, you know, cleans the pipes. Anyway, so Emerson is known for transcendentalism, which is basically a rejection of Calvinism and believing in yourself. Having self-reliance, independence, not needing any intermediator between you and whatever higher power you so choose to believe in. And it was influenced by the Romantics over in Europe.
And by the way, can I just jump in?
Yeah, go ahead.
My favorite quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson.
Yeah, go ahead.
An institution is nothing but the long shadow of one man. It's been true everywhere I've worked.
Beautiful.
Anyway, go ahead.
Beautiful. Well, I just needed one of those pregnant pauses because that was a winner. That was as my father-in-law.
Or one woman that was these days.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
All right. So now Thoreau, who is living at the Emerson home, he moves back in with his folks after about 2 years. But he tries to still write. He wants to be a writer, but he can't focus because, you know, pencils, when you make them, I imagine it makes a lot of noise. So his parents are also taking in boarders because they're not people of means. So he decides to ask the Emersons if he can borrow some land on the shore of Walden Pond. And so this is where the magic.
So that's how it all began.
Yeah, so this is how the magic happens. So he spends 2 years, which the book condenses into one. And he moves in on July 4th. 1845, and he has two purposes for moving into this little place. He wants to write a book in peace and quiet. And, you know, that's my idea, the best holiday ever, to go on vacation to a really nice hotel with a suitcase of books and just have it rain and have good room service.
That would be paradise for
you. Wouldn't that be great? Oh,
yeah.
Okay, so anyway. So he goes in for two purposes, to write a book and to experiment. His experiment is, can he work for one day and devote the other six to transcendental concerns? So that's about learning about the self, trying to become a better self, being an individual, understanding your whole place in the universe, believing in the inherent goodness of people and nature. And basically, people aren't too happy with this because it's really the reverse of that Yankee Protestant work ethic of, you know, you work 6 days and you rest on the Sabbath. So people in town are going, what? What's that man doing out? You know, that's a little strange. What's going on? And they start asking him questions like, what are you doing? So he decides to write responses, which become the book.
That becomes Walden.
Yeah. So his explanation of why actually grows into two books. And I actually have a beautiful copy here from Modern Library from 1950 that I got at a thrift shop down
and
in Delray 100 years ago.
And I see that you have it marked. You have a bookmark here.
I do.
Would you
I
be
do.
Willing to read a little from Walden?
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. I don't know. That's pretty heavy. But, you know... I would love to.
Okay.
I'll just go ahead and not only will I read from Walden, I'll tell you what others have said about Walden. It's broken up into reading, sound, solitude, visitors, the village, the pond. I mean, it's luscious and it is in its embrace of environmentalism. And, you know, full disclosure, I'm a University of Florida master naturalist. I'll say it again, which means you don't run around naked, but you know stuff about nature. And so...
This
really speaks to me. So it's a very small book. My copy is a Modern Library 1950, and it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, it is just, I don't know if you can hear the pages.
Yes.
Over. I mean, doesn't that sound good? It's good paper. Everything about it is perfect. When I wrote the following pages, or rather the bulk of them, I lived alone in the woods, a mile from any neighbor, in a house which I had built myself on the shore of Walden Pond in Concord, Massachusetts, and earned my living by the labor of my hands only. I lived there 2 years, 2 months. At present, I am a sojourner in civilized life again. P.S. I heard his sister did do his laundry.
Oh, he had a little help, didn't he?
Yeah. So
not totally alone in that Walden Pond cabin.
Not totally alone. But let me read to you, because I have two recommendations that I want to talk about also that are related. I want to bring Thoreau into Florida for us. So I'm suggesting two books today, and hopefully when we meet again, I can bring other natural Florida books to the table for our listeners. But I want to talk about Bill Belville's book, River of Lakes, A Journey on the St. John's River. And this was published in 2001. And it is I have a signed copy. I went on a St. John's river cruise, and he spoke. So that was a bucket list thing, two for one. Anyway, he recently won a Fellow Man Stetson Kennedy Foundation Award for his work with nature. And
nice.
This is a beautiful book that talks about... how the St. John's River is really a series of lakes. And he has a beautiful quote, if I may read, that talks about, he says that Thoreau, so Belville's influenced by Thoreau, never saw this system, but he surely read Bartram's description of it. And I am also recommending Travels of William Bartram. So I'm recommending two books for our readers today that have some type of connection to our dear Walden. And this is, again, what I talk about when I talk about Biblionexu. What happens when you become a reader is you start to see these connections. So when you
And you become eager to read related titles.
Right.
Sure.
And you start to see greater connections in the world around you. So if you go ahead and you open up the beginning of William Bartram's book, which was published in the late 1700s, it talks about, wouldn't you know, it talks about Thoreau and it talks about Emerson. So it's just amazing to think that all these books have this amazing grand connection. So Bill Belville summarizes that Thoreau, who was influenced by Emerson, okay, read Bartram's book. So in order to get Walden, which everyone pretty much knows, he read this, okay? So now Emerson who his transcendentalism was influenced by people over in Europe, such as Samuel Taylor Coleridge, who wrote the Rime of the Ancient Mariner. You know, when people say they have an albatross around their neck.
Coleridge.
Coleridge. So Coleridge and Carlyle, they also they influenced Emerson, and they also suggest that people read Travels of William Bartram.
And so the circle gets the square.
So the circle gets even, you know, it gets small. It's like the best cocktail party ever. So you have Bartram, Belleville, Emerson, Coleridge, Thoreau. They've all influenced my literary life. And this is why I am bringing it to you, dear readers. Now, why do I say dear readers? Because Dickens speaks in second person, and he addresses people, and he says, dear readers, when you open up like the first page of The Tale of Two Cities, you're called to attention. And who influenced Dickens? Okay, but someone named Thomas Carlyle, who was also a romantic, who influenced Emerson, who influenced Thoreau. So see, it's this whole circle. It's all who you know. So the more you know, the more you read, the more you learn, the more you can understand others. I mean, just literature is so amazing.
And who could make it more accessible to our listeners than you?
Oh, you're very
kind. You're the best.
Now, let me tell you something. Let's end with this quote. Books are the carriers of civilization. Without books, history is silent, literature numb, science crippled, thought and speculation at a standstill. Thank you, Thoreau.
And thank you, Stacy Goldring. You can meet Stacy in person, by the way. She has a physical book club at the San Marco Bookstore. The Jacksonville Public Library is our partner, meanwhile, in the on-air book club. Pick up a copy of Walden or perhaps William Bartram, Travels with William Bartram at the library, and go to Stacy's website, chapterendnotes.com. If you missed a little bit of this discussion and you want to look a little further, always great to see you.
Same, same.
And happy birthday to William, or not William, Henry.
Henry David Thoreau. I know we talked about so many people.
That's our show.
So much fun.
Yeah, that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merchart. Michelle Corum runs the board. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app. Listen there anytime. 1A's up next with a closer look at the sons of President Donald Trump. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.